Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Speaker of the House of Representatives Dennis Hastert is in the hospital today to have kidney stones removed. House Majority Leader Tom DeLay will pick up the gavel in Hastert's absence, just as DeLay faces new questions about possible ethics violations. The Washington Post reports today that a Russian oil company with possible ties to U.S. lobbyists funded DeLay's 1997 trip to Moscow, while the New York Times says that DeLay's political action and campaign committees have paid his wife and daughter more than $500,000. Well, joining us is Newsweek political correspondent Richard Wolff. And Richard, let's start with the allegations that a company, Chelsea, paid for DeLay's trips to Russia. How serious is that charge?
Well, this comes after a series of very similar allegations about other trips, really involving the same kind of pattern where corporate interests, lobbying interests, spend money generally through a nonprofit, an education nonprofit, which doesn't have to disclose its donors. And they're paying for really trips that can't be justified as fact-finding things by members of Congress, which happen all the time. These really look like junkets. Things like the golfing trip to Scotland followed a very similar model. This is another questionable trip by Tom DeLay.
Well, and by the way, Tom DeLay's aides are saying that the National Center for Public Policy Research paid for and sponsored the Russian trip. That is their response. But they'd already been criticized for that because that group is a conservative education group closely linked to a powerful Republican lobbyist.
Right. And what people are seeing in these trips is that these lobbyists or corporate interests are donating money to this nonprofit around the same time that Tom DeLay is taking these trips. So it's the pattern, it's the timing. As the Wall Street Journal editorial page, which is not one of Tom DeLay's traditional enemies, has said, there is an odor about this. And that's what you're seeing about all of this swirl of stories, of revelations about Tom DeLay.
Well, and some say it applies to the second story in today's papers. Fees paid to Tom DeLay's wife and daughter, his political action committee, Americans for a Republican Majority, or ARMPAC, said that DeLay's wife, Christine, provided long-term strategic guidance. His daughter, Dani DeLay Farrow, is an experienced professional event planner. And we know that other politicians do pay family members to work on campaigns. So what is the, if you will, odor here?
Well, it's the amount of money. You're talking about something like $500,000 since 2001. It's a lot of money, mostly where this kind of thing happens, and it is normal for family members to be involved in re-election campaigns. But when this kind of stuff happens, the amounts involved are really superficial. There may be a couple of thousand here or there. At the most, they may end up as being sort of 10 or 20,000. But 500,000 over this relatively short period of time is really exceptional.
A former exterminator from Texas who came to Washington vowing to clean up that kind of behavior, the behavior he's being charged with. And when you say Tom DeLay goes the extra distance, of course, we're thinking of most recent news. He spearheaded the effort to have Congress intervene in the Terri Schiavo case by pushing through a law that required federal courts to review the case. How is that reflecting on him a week later?
Well, not terribly well. There was an assumption made that this would be good for conservatives and for Republicans in general. Obviously, the polling did not support that in any way, shape, or form. That was a political miscue, which, again, it's in the mix here that weakens him politically.
Well, the executive director of DeLay's political action committee was indicted in Texas last year on charges of illegal fundraising. Texas prosecutors haven't ruled out possible charges against DeLay. When could we see movement on that front?
Oh, well, this is going on for some time. I mean, it could happen any time. And, of course, another indictment, especially of this lobbyist who's close to, Jack Abramoff, may be the straw that breaks the camel's back. But you're also going to see, I think, a defensive move here by supporters of Tom DeLay, who are going to say this is a liberal conspiracy. The indictments are, as they have charged before, really sort of cooked up by a Democrat district attorney in Texas. So what they're saying is this is going to be a political attack. There may well be another chapter of this, which is the rallying around Tom DeLay.
And I'm wondering, will there also be a counter move to maybe jettison someone who keeps incurring negative headlines for the party?
Well, there could be, and of course there was a bigger fish that was caught before, and that was Newt Gingrich. So nobody is indispensable here, and Tom DeLay seems powerful, but then so did Newt, and politics can be pretty brutal in that sense.
Richard Wolff, political correspondent for Newsweek. Richard, thanks.
Thank you.
All week, we've been taking a spiritual accounting of the state of the Catholic Church. Today, a financial accounting. Pope John Paul II was the head of a huge financial enterprise. The Vatican is a sovereign country with income from real estate properties and other investments, and millions of contributions to Peter's Pence, the Pope's own charitable wing. On the expense side, 118 missions around the world, thousands of employees, and the huge complex of buildings that is Vatican City. So what is the financial state of the Church as one leader is buried and another chosen to ascend the throne of Peter? Joining us in the studio is John Pollard. He's a fellow in history at Cambridge University's Trinity Hall in England and the author of the recent released book Money and the Rise of the Modern Papacy. And John, welcome.
Thank you very much.
First of all, many of us, you know, the Catholic Church is shrouded in mystery. So explain, first of all, we'll get a history of the Church in a moment, but how does it work? How is the Vatican structured?
Well, internally, it's a fairly tight organization. It's headed, of course, by the Pope himself, who is, in theory and usually in practice, an absolute monarch. He can make the decisions and he can unmake them. And the chief executive officer under the Pope is the Cardinal Secretary of State, who is the equivalent of the Prime Minister of a country. Mm-hmm. And then there are various other departments of the Roman Curia, the central government of the Roman Catholic Church, which administer various things like missionary outreach, the appointment of bishops, and so on and so forth. And there are also tribunals, for example, matrimonial tribunals. And there are also agencies that deal with the Vatican's finances.
Well, I was going to ask, you say there is sort of a CEO under the Pope. Which cardinal is that? And is he in charge of the money? Who is in charge, finally, of the money?
At the moment, the Cardinal Secretary of State has a general overall authority over the various other departments of the central government of the Church. But there are individuals who have responsibility for the finances of the Vatican. And then there is the Vatican Bank, which is virtually a law unto itself even now.
Mm. And the name of the Secretary of State?
Cardinal Sodano.
Well, is it transparent? Is there a board of directors? Are there financial statements?
There are financial statements, yes. I wouldn't say it's completely transparent because there are not financial statements absolutely every year, but we have a sense of what the Vatican financial state is from time to time. We know that, but it's not as transparent as in, say, for example, a corporation.
Right. Well, and as we know, some of those aren't very transparent either, as we've learned recently. But we understand that recent budgets of the Vatican City-State and the Holy See add up to about $500 million?
That's probably correct, yes. The Vatican City-State is probably itself self-financing because it actually is one of the few parts of the whole structure which earns money from tourism, from the museums, from stamps. Postage stamps make lots of money. Mm. From coin collections, philately, numismatics, and so on. The Vatican, as a state, as a sovereign independent state, is probably self-sufficient.
Right. And where else does the money come into the Catholic Church? We think of the plates that are passed in Sunday services, let's say here in the United States. Does that money go to the Vatican?
Yeah, a part of it. What you described earlier as Peter's Pence, which is a very considerable amount of money, is collected in every individual country which has a sizable Catholic population. And is handed onwards to the Vatican. But the Vatican, as you also suggested, makes money from its real estate, from its investments. Its investments stretch right the way across the world, and they're in all sorts of different things. It has its own gold reserve, for example. It invests in currencies. It obviously invests in stocks and bonds.
Yeah. And by the way, do we know what percentage of collection, in other words, what percentage of money that Catholics in the U.S. might put in a collection plate, might give to their local churches, what percentage of that goes to the Pope, Peter's Pence?
I would find it very hard to answer that question, but I think one, if I could turn the question around, I can say that U.S. Catholics are still probably the largest contributors to Peter's Pence in the whole world.
Yeah. But we just don't have a sense of how much.
Probably about a third to 40% of Peter's Pence collections come from the U.S. of A.
And let's start with Peter's Pence. And when we talk about the outgoing money, what is that spent on?
Well, you mentioned earlier the Vatican's network of diplomatic envoys. The Vatican has diplomatic relations with almost as many countries as the United States of America or the United Kingdom. It has to spend huge amounts of money on the bureaucracy in Rome. You know, the Vatican has between 3,000 and 4,000 employees. That is the Vatican, the Holy See, as an entity. It still sends a lot of money to Catholic missions. All those things add up. I mean, that's quite a big expense.
Is it spending more now because this was a Pope John Paul II who reached out to so many? Does that mean that the Church is spending more?
I think so. I mean, he had very ambitious plans. He was, as we know, very active. He was the pilgrim pope, except, of course, that a lot of the costs of individual pilgrimages were met in some cases, at least in the cases of countries with reasonably high standards of living by the churches in those countries. But certainly he has been a very ambitious pope and he has expanded the activities of the Holy See.
Mm-hmm. And so all in all, this is money spent out. I'm just wondering, do we know how much the Vatican, the Catholic Church, is worth? Because we talked about its budget being $500,000, but how much are its investments worth? How much is it real estate worth? Do we know?
It's very difficult, and I'm not prepared to put a figure on the value of its stocks and shares portfolio. But let's, first of all, make some very clear distinctions. The Vatican, the Holy See, is not the same thing as the Roman Catholic Church throughout the world. And as you know, individual dioceses in the United States of America have their own budgets, and indeed individual parishes have their own budgets.
Well, let's stop you for a second, because not only are there parishes in this country, but there are 230 Catholic colleges, over 8,000 schools, over 500 hospitals. So let's be clear. Does the Vatican support financially the Catholic institutions in the U.S.?
No. I think we can safely say that. Apart from anything else, the Vatican's attitude will almost certainly be that Roman Catholics in the United States of America can look after themselves.
And had to.
And the same would be true also of other countries like Germany, France, Belgium. In other words, all the countries of the First World, the rich countries, the Vatican does not expect to have to provide financial support for those churches. It's a different matter if we talk about missionary areas in Asia or in Africa. But the point I was trying to make was we need to distinguish between the Roman Catholic Church in the field, on the ground, in dioceses, in countries, and the Vatican. In other words, the Holy See, the papacy as it exists, as it operates in the Vatican and in Rome.
John Pollard is a fellow in history at Trinity College at Cambridge University and author of Money and the Rise of the Modern Papacy. Well, when we come back, we're going to try to put a finger on the value of the Vatican, but also be reminded of the history of the Church's finances. For instance, how spending money on the Sistine Chapel was one of the things that gave birth to Protestantism. Stay there. There's much more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, continuing our conversation with John Pollard, author of the recently released book Money and the Rise of the Modern Papacy, Financing the Vatican, 1850 to 1950. And John, when we left off, we were trying to put a finger on what the Catholic Church is worth, and it's a hard thing to do, isn't it?
It's impossible. It's not just hard. It's impossible. We don't know how much individual dioceses are worth.
Well, and let's go back, because there was a time in 1929 when the Church almost went broke, and a lot of people may not remember their history. Who saved the Church?
You say it went broke. People are always crying wolf. The Church is always about to go broke. I'm not convinced that it's ever really been broke at any time in its history. But in 1929, the crucial thing was that the Vatican finally composed its quarrel with the Italian state, which, of course, had taken away from the papacy its territories, its sovereignty in central Italy, and gave the Vatican financial compensation, something like $91 million.
And this was an Italian state led by Benito Mussolini.
Led by Benito Mussolini, yes.
And then take us from there. The church grew. It invested that money.
Well, it invested its money after 1929, thanks to the cleverness of a very good Milanese banker called Bernardino Nogara, who spread the money around the world and put it into a variety of investments, including the New York Stock Exchange. It had no real problems, I think, until the 60s. But in the 60s, with the Second Vatican Council, which was an extraordinary event, which was a very expensive event, the bills started piling up. And you find other situations like that more recently in its history, particularly under this pontificate.
Before we move on in time, a couple of other historical moments. Don't some believe that the Catholic Church also received a huge amount of money that might have been pillaged from other people?
There are claims, and these claims have been pursued in American courts, that the very nasty fascist Ustasha regime in Croatia in the 1940s passed on to the Vatican something like $80 million worth of gold, which it had stolen from the coffers of the Yugoslav government, from its own banks, and allegedly also from Jews, from Gypsies, and from Serbs whom it had murdered. The documentary evidence, the archival evidence, is very slender for this, and it comes mainly, it has to be said, from the Washington National Archives of the United States of America. Lesser material is to be found in the British National Archives. But there's nothing conclusive about this. On the other hand, I think it is arguable that the Vatican was very favorable towards the idea of the Ustasha, because they had at least tried to defend Croatia against communism. And it's possible, but I've never been able to prove it, that if the Vatican did get the gold, then it maybe used it to help war criminals escape down the so-called rat lines to South America.
In reading your book, we see that there's another point in history where the finances of the church had to do with the future of the church. When the church financed the building of St. Peter's Basilica and paid Michelangelo for his frescoes?
And it financed the building of the basilica by selling indulgences, which is the remission of pain and penalty in purgatory. And of course, that stirred up a hornet's nest in Germany, and it led ultimately to the Protestant, the Lutheran Reformation. Mm.
Well, let's move forward to today. You said that the church had languished for several years. A U.S. cardinal was in part responsible for writing the church. This seemed to be in the early 90s when it started to have more smooth sailing financially.
Yes.
How has Pope John Paul II been as a steward of the church financially?
He's not been very good hands-on, and I think, but then that is true of a lot of the way in which he has run the church from the top, that he's tended to delegate the day-to-day practical, financial, legal side of the church to other people and get on with the charismatic business.
But was that different from previous popes?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Previous popes tended, by and large, to be more hands-on. They tended to want to know what was going on everywhere inside the Vatican administration.
We know that part of his focus on some of those outside issues was his focus on the Solidarity Movement in his own home country of Poland. Did he spend a lot of money there?
We are told that a lot of money was sent to Solidarity and probably was sent via the channels of the Vatican Bank.
Well, and some would say, is there anything wrong with that if it led to...
Absolutely. And why not?
Tearing down communism.
Yeah. Yes.
But then others might question just the secretive flow of money at that time. And, of course, many will remember the murky tale of Banco Ambrosiano. The head of that bank was found hanged. It was later found that he had not committed suicide, that he had possibly been strangled, and this after a scandal surrounding the bank. Could you just give us a quick thought on that?
Yeah. I mean, the problem was that the Vatican Bank, in the reign of Paul VI, that is from 1963 through to 1978, moved into circles which, as you described, were very murky. In particular, the head of the Vatican Bank, Archbishop Marcinkus, allowed the bank to be associated with bankers of very dubious, very, very dubious morality.
Well, mafia.
One was Roberto Calvi of the Banco Brosiano, but which then, after all, was supposed to be a Catholic bank. And the other was Sindona of the mafia. And inevitably, all sorts of deals were entered into, which were illicit, illegal, and the Vatican, in the end, probably lost something like $250 million. You know, there was that whole conspiracy theory that John Paul I was murdered in 1978. Remember, he only lasted a month.
Right.
Because he made so many enemies, because he was trying to clear out the Augean stables in the Vatican and really sort things out.
And suddenly he's found dead.
He was found dead, and I think we now are pretty clear that he died. I mean, we don't need conspiracy theories to explain his heart attack. But certainly, the one complaint that has been made against John Paul II is that he didn't move sufficiently quickly and with the necessary vigor to resolve this situation in the Vatican Bank at the beginning of his reign. The Vatican Bank, certainly by the mid to late 1980s, was under new management and very ethical management, it has to be said.
John Pollard is a fellow in history at Cambridge University's Trinity Hall in England and the author of the recently released book Money and the Rise of the Modern Papacy. John, thanks so much for joining us.
Not at all.
And tomorrow on Here and Now, in the 12th century, the Catholic Church was ordaining married men before policy was changed. So why can't policy be changed again to ordain women? We'll ask one woman theologian that question. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. About a year ago, a headline in the Boston Globe read, U.S. stem cell research lagging. Another read, Harvard teams want okay to clone human cell. The byline under those headlines, Gareth Cook, Globe staff. Well, now you can add Pulitzer Prize winner to that title as well. Cook just won the prize for his explanatory reporting about stem cells, and he joins us in the studio as well. Welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
And congratulations to you.
Thank you.
First of all, just remind us, what exactly are stem cells?
Stem cells are cells in the body that have the ability to become other cells. This makes them very interesting to scientists because you might be able to use them to repair tissues. There are stem cells we've known about for decades, and they appear in the bone marrow. So when you hear of someone having a bone marrow transplant, what they're really getting is stem cells that replace their blood. What's happened more recently is the discovery of so-called embryonic stem cells. These are stem cells that are more powerful in a sense because they can become any cell in the body, not just blood cells. And that's what has started this whole debate.
But because there's a lot of controversy because many people view embryos, even those that have been discarded at fertility clinics, for instance, as life.
Exactly. So this has sort of brought up the debate that's been raging for so long about abortion, which is when does human life begin? And in order to get embryonic stem cells, you need to destroy an embryo. So the question is that a human life we're destroying or not? Another twist to this that has made the debate even more passionate and we've seen play out here in Massachusetts is the use of cloning technology. So in other words, to create embryos by cloning human cells. And this allows scientists to do things they can't do any other way. However, it raises even more ethical questions.
Right. That cloning of those embryos, would it be just of the embryos?
You're not really cloning an embryo. What you're doing is you're taking a cell from someone. So let's say I wanted to clone one of your cells. I would take a skin cell from you and I would put the DNA from that skin cell and I would put it into an egg cell. And that egg then turns into an embryo. And from that embryo, which is a ball of cells, 100 or 200 cells, you then can get embryonic stem cells.
And could that embryo ever become me?
In theory, it could be. And the example of that is Dolly the sheep. So that's how Dolly was created. They took the skin cell from another sheep and put it into an egg. They followed that whole process and got Dolly. No scientist that I've ever talked to would want to do that because it would be very dangerous for the child, and also it's very difficult for it to actually work. So in other words, if you put an embryo that's created that way back into the uterus, almost all the time it doesn't develop.
Is the research promising? Might this kind of embryonic stem cell research lead to cures for diseases such as Parkinson's and diabetes?
Well, that's a very difficult question in a way. The short answer is yes, it might, but it all turns on what you mean by might. So this is a very promising field. Scientists are very excited about it. Just in the last few years, there's been a tremendous amount of progress. At the same time, you can never predict when science is going to turn into medicine. So it's promising, but we also don't know.
Meanwhile, lawmakers here in Massachusetts are working on a final version of a law designed to promote research on human embryonic stem cells. A similar law was approved in California last fall. How would you see each side as characterizing this debate?
Well, basically, if you look at the two sides, you have one side saying, this is amazing, we're going to be able to cure people of Parkinson's disease and spinal cord injury. And on the other side, you have people saying, we can cure these diseases other ways.
And also accusing the other side of cloning.
Exactly, and basically of killing human beings by destroying embryos.
Yeah. Well, you set out in your writing, in your exquisite writing, by the way, to find the human stories behind that national debate. I'm looking at a couple here. One, desperate parents chase a stem cell miracle. What happened in that story?
Well, there's a family in Sutton, Massachusetts, an amazing family. They have a son with muscular dystrophy, which is a disease that slowly destroys the muscles, and there's no cure for it. And they were looking for something to do for their son, and they'd heard about all this hype about stem cells, and you know, they'd heard this big national debate about stem cells, and they heard the proponent saying how close cures are. And when you're in that state, what you hear is, maybe I can help my son. One night they were looking on the web and they came across this website for MCell, which is a clinic in the Ukraine, which is offering embryonic stem cell treatments. And they went there and they received treatment for their son. And the story is about their journey and about what brought them there. And it's also about these clinics which are offering things for which there's no proof that it works.
Yeah, it's a story of a heartbreak and in essence being taken by people.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you have a story about a mother who had to make a decision. She was a Catholic. She had two children through in vitro fertilization and was asked by the clinic if they could give her extra embryos to Harvard for research.
Right. So this is a very interesting story, and one of the stories early on last year that made me realize what an amazing topic this is, because you have people on both sides offering a caricature. You have proponents saying embryos are just a ball of cells and we should let researchers do what you want. You have opponents of the research saying an embryo is a baby and to destroy that is the same as killing a person. So I spent time with this family, which actually had frozen embryos, trying to decide what to do with them. And in their struggle, you see how much more complicated it is. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, you can't tell someone this is just a ball of cells when it's given them the two most important things in their life, which is two children. That just, it's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, to say that these embryos, that they have a whole bank of embryos, that they're the same as a child, the same as their child, is also ridiculous. Through that story, I think I was able to give some sense. I wasn't able to give an answer, but just give a sense for how complicated and how profound some of these questions are.
And through writing like that, you won the Pulitzer Prize. And we're going to link to your writing so people can read it and get that full picture that you explored about embryonic stem cell research. Gareth Cook, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Gareth Cook, Pulitzer Prize winning journalist. Have you gotten used to that yet?
No. I like the sound of it, though.
Of the Boston Globe. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Robin.
American author and Nobel Prize winner Saul Bellow wrote larger-than-life characters on a quest to find meaning in the modern world. What might he have someday written about stem cell research? Bellow died yesterday at the age of 89. Here he reads from his last novel, 2001's Ravelstein, on NPR's The Connection.
Ravelstein, dressing to go out, is talking to me, and I go back and forth with him while trying to hear what he is saying. The music is pouring from his hi-fi. He winds up his tie, lifting the collar that crackles with starch. He makes a luxurious knot. The unsteady fingers, long, ill-coordinated, nervous to the point of decadence, make a double lap. Ravelstein likes a big tie knot. After all, he is a large man. He smokes, of course, he's always smoking, and tilts the head away from the smoke while he knots and pulls the knot into place.
Saul Bellow reading an excerpt from his novel Ravelstein. The Nobel Prize winner died yesterday at the age of 89. Still to come, comic Paula Poundstone on the charges she faced of child endangerment, on being a single mom, and on the comeback trail. You're listening to Here and Now. Thank you. About one in three adults in the U.S. use some form of alternative medicine, acupuncture, herbal medicine, or chiropractic care. But they usually don't tell their medical doctors about it. And while many major hospitals do offer some form of alternative care, these two different worlds of healing are still very separate. Dr. Ted Kapchuk is very interested in the idea of integrative medicine. He's a doctor of Chinese medicine and an assistant professor at Harvard Medical School. Here now is Dr. Terry Schrader spoke with Kapchuk recently and asked him to define the term integrative medicine.
Integrative is a word that people developed maybe 10 years ago or less even, where there was an attempt to take the best of alternate world, the best of mainstream world, and make one kind of medicine.
And did that happen? I know we heard a lot from academic medical centers announcing hospital-based acupuncture programs, and now we don't hear so much. Did it happen?
I don't think it happened. I think that there was attempts to bring into major medical centers, academic medical centers, different kinds of alternative therapists and make this kind of therapy available. But I think the profit margins were not sufficient to sustain it. That I don't think it made a major dent.
But if you look at the recent studies, as well as studies you were involved with 15 years ago, alternative medicine is very popular, but people don't tell their traditional biomedical doctor that they're doing it. Why is this still the case?
I think that especially for older practitioners of biomedicine, there's a belief that anyone that would use acupuncture, chiropractic, botanicals, or meditate, that they're kind of ignorant or believe in superstitious practices and they're not up to snuff with real science. And people don't want to be treated poorly. I think that's shifting as younger practitioners realize that mainstream medicine doesn't have a monopoly on how people think about illness and health. The younger physicians and some of the older ones are beginning to learn how to ask in non-judgmental ways about alternate medicine use. But the process has been slower than one would have anticipated.
Western medicine prides itself on evidence-based science, working within the scientific evidence. And yet you can't always do that with alternative medicine. I think that makes some people quite suspect.
Well, evidence-based medicine is a methodology having to do with randomization, blinding, understanding mechanism in terms of biochemistry. That's the basis of modern medicine since after World War II. Alternative therapies very often are much older, and they're based on just observing the phenomena, a kind of belief that you can observe, that you believe in what you see and you believe in what you get. They're not haunted by a placebo effect. So the basis of a lot of the practices of alternate medicine are not evidence-based, and there may be a small tendency within alternate medicine to begin to think in those terms, but basically these are different conceptual frameworks of how you know something works or doesn't work.
But if the practice of alternative medicine and biomedicine hasn't been integrated, the research into this area has. 12 years ago, the NIH budget was something like $2 million, which, of course, isn't a lot in the biomedical research community. And now it's over $100 million.
There's a huge amount of research. For example, I'm involved in a very, very large clinical trial looking at whether or not acupuncture is effective for irritable bowel syndrome, a real difficult medical situation. That trial would have not been conceivable 10 years ago. So what's happened is there's been a major shift. Medicine knows it has to look at alternate therapies. Alternate therapists want to be looked at. That convergence has led to a real significant synergy and blossoming of alternate medicine.
And finally, have these two very different worlds learned anything from each other over the past two decades?
I think that the dialogue that's been mediated by science has been tremendously fruitful for both sides of this equation of alternative versus mainstream. Alternative providers, for example, 10 years ago would not have been aware that there's potential herb-drug interactions without the modern scientific research that's happened in the last 5 to 6 years. I think mainstream providers have really learned that maybe there's something about the doctor-patient relationship they need to examine, or maybe there's something, some therapies, some botanicals that may be valuable that they're overlooking. And I think there really is been a major learning curve because of the dialogue that science has mediated.
Dr. Ted Kapchuk of Harvard Medical School speaking with Here and Now's Dr. Terry Schrader about integrative medicine. Stay with us. There's more ahead Here and Now. I'm I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Comic Paula Poundstone is doing just fine, thanks. She's touring, raising three kids as a single mom, appearing on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and with her cat, Hep, maintaining a website. It's been almost 4 years since Paula was charged with child endangerment and had her children temporarily removed because of driving with the kids in the car while drunk. Paula says that incident is receding in the rearview mirror. Originally from the Boston area, Paula came through town for a show recently, and when we sat down to talk, most on her mind was getting back to her kids in L.A. and her constant search for familiar food.
For example, Drake's is only sold in 6 states. Which I didn't know. Had I known that, I might not have gone to California.
Drake's, which makes a cupcake. I mean,
right,
Ringdings,
right, Ringdings and Yodels, right. And Yankee Doodles, Devil
sure.
Dogs.
Only
you
in
know,
six
staples.
States.
They're only sold in 6 states, which I know because I followed a delivery truck once. That's a fact. Yeah, so, you know, I had to keep coming home to eat.
Well, Paula Poundstone, back here in Boston, and I have to say, I am a fan of your website.
Well, thank you so much.
How much time do you spend on it, by the way?
A lot. I handwrite everything.
You're kidding.
No, and it gets typed in and put in by other people, and I take the pictures. Actually, you know, the funniest thing of the website is I do an interview of an Academy Award-winning prop master. Many of the props that she handed to the performers are presented on the website, photographs of them, and one of them, the photograph of the keys, believe it or not, I kept readjusting. I had to get the photo just right. It took me forever.
Let's explain. The keys are, the prop master is telling you the keys are from The Apartment?
Yes, from the movie The Apartment. These are the actual keys used in the movie The Apartment.
Oh, wait, here's more. There's a picture of one of those socks that has holders
toes.
For each toe.
Yeah.
Like, it's like a mitten, but for a foot. And she tells you this is literally my left foot.
Yes, this is this is a prop from my left foot.
You didn't notice the rainbow-colored striped sock.
No, I didn't remember that from my left foot, nor the woolly glove from Patton.
Well, and I'm looking, too, at the Ask Paula to Ask Hep Cat portion. And you explain why you have one of your 10 cats, isn't it?
Yes.
On the website, and you say, one, I thought of 10 good names for 10 good cats. Two, I used to drink a lot. Three, I'm lonely and only one of them will talk to me, that being Hepcat. Let's go back to two for just a second.
What's that? Two, I used to drink a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How are you doing with that?
Oh, I'm great. I haven't had a drink in 3.5 years, and I just found out the other day, by the way, that it's alcohol you can't drink. What a relief. I was dry and parched. There was an almost papery quality about my skin. I'm doing very well. Thank you for asking. Yeah. You know, I tell my little jokes. I do my job. It's been 3.5 years, thank goodness, yeah. Since our difficulties. I'll tell you one thing, though. I had insights into into both the media and the world of justice in our country that I don't wish upon anybody, but it certainly was informative. Yeah. You know,
you were. It was not a very good experience.
Oh, it was a horrible experience, and certainly brought on by me, by the way. Because I had a drinking problem and I didn't take care of it. I honestly, looking back, in the first place, I deeply regret the mistakes that I made. But in the second place, I feel so stupid because it seems so clear now that I had a drinking problem. It did not seem clear at the time, I can see now that there were red flags. I didn't see them then, and in my defense, I'll say I was drunk. That's kind of the good news and the bad news about drinking, is that the red flags are kind of blurry, and they zip on by.
That's right. Well, and I was thinking, well, maybe this is old news, and then I saw, just quickly, we're looking at some articles, and there's one from just this past March. Your children brought it up. I can't remember how they referred to it, the incident or something
Once in a blue moon, something comes up where we sort of refer to that time, but very gingerly and not very frequently at all. I mean, I think they were just as happy to put it behind us. You know, it was sort of, it was a time of unspeakable sadness. And so they really were just as happy not to, you know, not to hammer away at it. And, you know, we've been reunited for years,
right.
And it was a horrible time and very sad to be separated. It really changed my life in some ways, which is that I don't do two things at once anymore. You know, it used to be that when I was with my kids, I'd be doing an interview on the phone, or I'd be, it's not that I wasn't with them, I was, but I didn't mind trying to do my work at the same time as I was taking care of them. And lots of working parents have to do that. But now I won't do that. I'm gone about 8 nights a month. And the rest of the time, while they're at school, I work like a dog trying to finish all my stuff. And then, you know, I bring them to school, I pick them up from school, and I am absolutely theirs for that entire time, which probably, in some ways, gives us more hours together than a lot of parents are able to do. So I'm really lucky about the kind of job that I have.
For other mothers who have had drinking problems and have wrestled with them, what do you tell your kids about that?
I let them know that it was my problem and not theirs, and that they, I think there was a little period of time where somebody somewhere, not me, told them that they somehow had to be vigilant. And boy, I nipped that one right in the bud. I'm like,
it's not their job.
Yeah, absolutely not. I think somebody actually told that to my oldest daughter one time, and the first time I heard her say it, I thought my head would shoot off my shoulders.
Right.
I just said, you know, I mean, I have not, you know, everybody breaks promises once in a while. That is a promise I have not broken, which is, you know what? I will be in charge of me, yeah, and I will take care of you as well.
Yeah.
And I have managed. You know, everybody's going to make mistakes. And I hope that the thing that we can look back on, because everyone's going to reflect, and I'm sure the teenagers will be brutal in terms of their reflection on my job. But I hope that the thing that we can all look back on is that, you know what? In a very human way, I made some mistakes, and I jumped right back up again, dusted myself off as quickly as I could, and moved quickly to continue moving forward. You know, they've forgiven me. We've moved on, and the three of them are really great kids, and I have worked harder at their education than I ever possibly could have at my own, and I'm hoping someday they notice that.
Is there ever going to be a time when there's humor around that? Or is
we don't talk about that. But in my act, I do. I don't talk about it as much as I did in the immediate aftermath. I guess I don't need to, for one thing. And my act is largely autobiographical. And so mostly what I talk about now is, you know, taking care of my children and taking care of all those... horrible pets in my house.
Yeah, you brought them.
I know. I swear, my entire life is spent with a damp cloth.
Tell me one thing about your kid. Tell me one thing from your show about your kids to share something with us.
Oh, gee. All right, well, here's one. My children go to very multi-ethnic schools. You know, they talk a lot about the holidays of all the different cultures and the, you know, this and the that. And so my children are constantly angry with me that we don't celebrate all of the holidays. And I keep trying to explain to them that we're not all of those things. And they get mad that we don't celebrate Easter. And I say to them, first of all, it's not part of our religious beliefs. And second of all, you don't like eggs. And third of all, you don't look for anything. I go find your socks. Happy Easter.
Paula Poundstone, so nice to talk to you.
Well, thank you so much. Nice to talk to you.
Comic Paula Poundstone. To check out Paula's spring and summer comedy club dates and her website, go to ours, here-now.org.
That's life.
That's life.
I tell you, I can't deny it. I thought of quitting, baby. But my heart just ain't gonna buy it. And if I didn't think it was worth one single try, I'd jump right on a big bird and then I'd fly.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
A pawn and a king, I've been up and down and over and out. And I know one thing, each time I find myself laying flat on my face, I just pick.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.